was on board with adoption the whole time.
Yeah, I wasn't. Every time we would hear a story of people that had adopted a child, it just resonated with us. It was something that we would always just kind of walk away from and go, you know, that's really neat. It's obviously biblical thought.
I just felt like, I guess after reading scripture, I could just see that God really cares for everyone, but just specifically for those that don't have parents, and that as Christians, that we should do something about it.
I know I'm just as much God's as anyone else, you know, that I've been adopted into His family, and Kaysen's, you know, same with us.
When Karen first approached me with the idea of adoption, I was not on board with it. A part of me is ashamed to say that now as I look back on it, but because a lot of it was for selfish reasons. And I think that's when it really hit me that I said, man, you know, there's kids out there who are hurting, and there's kids out there who are suffering right now, and if we can be a part of God's plan in some way, some form or fashion, to be able to bring them into a stable, loving environment, and then also help set their lives on a different path, introduce them to Christ, show them what it looks like to live as a Christian and have a relationship with God. I said, if we can do that and then forever change the direction of a kid's life like that, or be a part of that, then yeah, I'm all about that. I want to do that.
God just really brought to life the story of Moses to us and baby Moses, and it was so easy to make that clear to the girls and just to say, you know, there was Moses' mom and she could not take care of her child and protect him the way that she knew she needed to, and so she loved her child enough to let someone else raise him and care for him and protect him.
For me, it is a privilege and it is a huge blessing to be able to pour into these kids' lives and to be able to be their dad and give them something that quite possibly they might not have ever been able to experience. So we're very thankful.
All right. Well, welcome. My name is Matt Williams, and I'm on staff here, one of our elders. Looking forward to kind of leading us from the teaching side of things this weekend at all of our campuses, whether you're downtown or Golden Strip or Powdersville or Pelham Road, Saturday night, Sunday morning. Thanks to Red and Karen and Ed and Julie for being willing to give us just a small piece of their story. And it is a valuable part of what God's doing in the kingdom, what He's doing in their homes, what He's doing in our church, and for what's happening for a bunch of young children in our congregation. We have over 50 families who are involved in fostering and adoption and a whole bunch more that are considering it. And this has not been something that we've made this big push in our church. We've just made some of that aware, and people have moved to it and gravitated towards it. And so it's been a great privilege for our church to help gather resources. And when you are a part of a local body, though you may or may not be directly involved, you may not know this, that you are indirectly involved in giving, because you give to help give the resources that we support some of these families with, and the communication and the ability to gather people together, and whether it's staff or volunteers, to be able to pull all that together. So your faithfulness in giving and generosity and in being part of this body helps contribute to a greater movement that's happening, because the church is called to be involved because these are some of the most vulnerable folks in our society and in our culture, which becomes the theme and the launching pad for what we talk about this weekend in 1 Timothy 5. So if you have a Bible, turn to 1 Timothy chapter 5. If it looks like this in the seat in front of you, or if they're handing it out at Golden Strip or Powdersville, it's page 720. 1 Timothy 5, page 720. Is that when there's a group of people, whether inside our church or outside of our church, that carry the label of vulnerable, that they are vulnerable, that they are exposed, and being an orphan or being a widow would be examples, would be applications of vulnerability. But when someone is vulnerable or exposed, that is one of the attributes of the kingdom of God, is that we move in that direction, is that we gravitate towards that. is that's not something that we have to hide from or that we pull back from or that we let just kind of drift on its own. It's something that we move towards. And so Jesus moved towards it, and he calls his church to move towards it because, and here's what we're going to see, it is the nature of family. So you have your original family that gets pulled apart when you get married, and then you get new family, creates a new family of origin for a new generation. And then you have the spiritual family that you see manifested in the Gospels very clearly. When Jesus is teaching and the crowd presses in and the disciples come and say, your family's here, your mother and your brothers are here. And he says, who? Interesting. Who are my mother and my brothers? But those who follow me, who do what I say, who follow my commands. And then on the cross, he's dying. He looks at John. He says, John, behold your mother. Mom, behold your son. John, I need you to take care of her. You're our new family. I'm out. Now, right? And so you see this emphasis on family. You see it go through the New Testament, so that church is family in some very powerful and unique ways. But let's, and we're going to look at the big chunk here. So let's start 1 Timothy chapter 5 as we'll look at our own vulnerability. He gives us two verses to introduce the idea of family. Verse 1, never speak harshly to an older man, but appeal to him respectfully as you would your own father. And he kind of qualifies the tension in this, is that Timothy's a young leader, is going to have to work with some older, more mature men. And notice he leans on the idea of family. Speak to him as you would a father. In other words, show him some honor, show him some respect. Let me just acknowledge a big moment of gratitude and thank you. Because when we started our church, we had some college students and some young and young couples and young singles. And so there were people that were younger than I was. But when as soon as our church started growing, every man who came was older than I was. Okay? And so let me just say, for those men who've been in our church a long time, is that they were incredibly patient with me, gracious with me, enduring with me. And I just want to do a kind of a broad thank you. I could go and name the names of Tom Proctor and Tom Fowler, and there's a whole list of names that I could give of guys who I know they walked away from meetings with me thinking, God, are you really using him? Is that who we're using? Right? But they were very patient with me as maturity came very slowly. But he says, be to this younger guy, don't speak harshly to them. Appeal to them. Make an appeal. Talk to younger men as you would your brother. So there's a bond here, and brothers will argue and they will scrap, but there's a bond that's supposed to override that. Treat older women as you would your mother. Once again, honor and respect as we would in a family, even though there's going to be challenges and confrontations and exhortations. And treat younger women with all purity as you would your own sisters. And there is a great moment of clarification as he says, you have two kinds, if you're a man, you have two kinds of women in the world that you're relating to. You're relating to your wife or you're relating to your sister. Whether you are married or single, she's either your wife or she's your sister. And so he clarifies that one with all purity because there is a great temptation for that relationship to not be healthy. So he is acknowledging and speaking in terms of family to older men, to older women, to younger men, to younger women in the context of family. And then he will move us into this vulnerable part of family called the widow. And it will be for us a test of faith, how we handle those that are most vulnerable, whether orphans or widows. James 1, we'll look at that in just a second. We'll put those, lump those together for us because they are both vulnerable. Becomes a test of our faith. And so this good work doesn't stand as opposed to our faith. It is part of our faith. These are not things that are working against each other, but they are working together. And so when we're dealing with the most vulnerable, this is the challenge for us. And it's a true test. Any challenge is a hard thing, is a real test of what you really believe, what you really feel, what you really think. So in your parenting, all right, middle of the night, child starts coughing. As a young parent, what do? You lay there like you don't hear it. And you go, surely he or she hears that and they'll handle that. And then at some point, he or she will say, you hear that? And you... real still. You got to be real still. And heavy breathing. Real still, heavy breathing, right? Are you awake? And at some point you have to go, no. Because it's so late you forget that speaking betrays the fact that you are, you know, actually awake. So it lets you know. So you, because who wants to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and handle something? You can't go back to sleep. Some of you can. Then cursed be you who can go back to sleep after you wake up. That's the test. Like, who doesn't want to go to Chuck E. Cheese and dance with Chuck E. Cheese? We love that part. Let's go to the birthday party. Have fun with little... I mean, that's awesome part. 3 o'clock in the morning, not so awesome. So the real test of parenting is the late night parenting, which makes my wife a much better parent than I am. All right, here we go. Here's the test. Verse 3. Take care of any widow who has no one else to care for her. So he begins to qualify right off the bat. Why? Because widow, vulnerable. This is in a culture where there's no Medicare, there's no Medicaid, there's no government help, no city help, no county help, no state help, no federal help. So what will happen to her? She will starve. If she can't work, she can't make money, she can't buy food, she can't eat, she will die. She is vulnerable. And he says, so take care of any widow who has no one else to care for her, because she is on your own. She is vulnerable. So James 1:27 reads like this. Just so you can see, we have this in another passage real clearly. James 1, we have that. It says, but genuine religion in the sight of God our Father means caring for orphans and widows in their distress. He said, this is pure, this is undefiled, this is clean, this is obviously what God wants for us. It is a blessing for us, and it's a test of our faith. Verse 4, but if she has children or grandchildren, their first responsibility is to show godliness at home and repay their parents by taking care of them. This is something that pleases God. There's a couple interesting things here. The children or grandchildren, they're in this downline of family. They have a responsibility to show godliness, not at church, but to show godliness at home, which we would say is real godliness, right? I mean, anybody can do it for a show at church, but what about at home? He says, so there's a responsibility to show godliness at home and repay the parents for taking care of them. Now, that's an interesting idea. As if I could even go back in time and recapture, because you can't. You can't actually repay it in a pure sense, because you can never recreate the moment. The vulnerability of a child and someone who was there in the moment. That can't actually be repaid, but the idea is that of honoring, of recognition and honoring that which was done for you. And this is really important. Then it says, and this is something that pleases God, which raises the question of, why would that, especially using a word like repay, where you're feels like you're earning something, why would the idea of repaying, earning, working, doing something, why would that be something that he would say, this is something that pleases God? I mean, I think the obvious, most obvious reason on the surface is someone's getting taken care of. Someone who is vulnerable and weak is getting taken care of, and that's a good thing. So that pleases God. I think there's a deeper level to it too. Is that if you think about it, from just step back from it for just a moment. Like, instead of being right up on the situation, go back to 30,000 feet. There's children or grandchildren. Their first responsibility is to show godliness at home and repay their parents for taking care of them. This is something that pleases God. Because if you'll think about a life and how it works, the beginning of life, vulnerable. Middle of life, strong in a normal, healthy life cycle. End of life, vulnerable and weak again. So there's only this short season when we have the illusion of strength and power. And he says, so while you're in this short season of strength and power, do not forget that the people who took care of you when you were weak, when you were frail, they were in a season of strength, and they gave up their season of strength to take care of you while you were weak and vulnerable. So now that you're in a season of strength, do not forget them who took care of you. And here's what God would say. If you can't get your mind wrapped around that logic and recognize that as much of a bootstrapper as you might think you are, and let's just acknowledge, this is not a male issue. Men and women both, I think, equally from a personality standpoint, have this idea in some personality types, I've got it, is that I'm going to make my own way, I'm going to handle my own deal, I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps, and even if I've been blessed, I'm going to take that to the next level, bootstrap, 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 right? And God says this, if you're a bootstrapper, but you can't stop for a moment and recognize that you're only in a season of strength, and that you wouldn't be in that season of strength if someone had not been there for you when you were weak. If you can't recognize that on a physical level, you will never recognize that on a spiritual level. is that Jesus came after you when you were weak, when you were frail, when you could not bring righteousness out of your own soul, you could not accomplish righteousness, you were broken, you were trapped in sin, and that he brought his strength to the cross for you to redeem you, something you couldn't do for yourself. Then in your greatest moment of weakness, your greatest need, he brought his great strength to bear and gave up his great strength in your weakness so that you could be redeemed. Because if you're so much of a bootstrapper that you can't get that physically, you'll never get that spiritually. So he goes, this pleases God that you can recognize that you might be in a season of strength, but that season of strength will fade. And so even in my season of strength, I need to display dependence. I need to recognize that that's just what I'm in. I'm in a season. That I was in a weak place, I'm strong now, and I will be in a weak place again. And that is true for every single person who has ever lived. Verse 5. Now a true widow, and he begins to qualify even more. First responsibility, show godliness here, right? In the home. But now we think about the church. A true widow, a woman who is truly alone. So now he's used the word true twice. True widow, truly alone in the world. She has placed her hope in God. She prays night and day, asking God for his help. So she's dependent on God. And when everything gets stripped away, that's kind of what we do. But the widow who lives only for pleasure is spiritually dead even while she lives. Notice him qualifying her. He says, this is a unique people group that not just are vulnerable, but in this specific application, she's godly. She is a godly woman who is in a unique situation, who actually has a unique contribution to make as well, but she's in a unique setting. She is not reckless. She's godly. Verse 7, give these instructions to the church so that no one will be open to criticism. And notice that theme runs throughout the book, the idea of credibility. Credibility with elders. Credibility with deacons. Credibility with Timothy as a communicator. Credibility, credibility in your walk, in your faith, as your salvation is being displayed. Always credibility. Give these instructions to the church so that no one will be open to criticism. Verse 8. But those who won't care for their relatives, especially those in their own household, have denied the true faith. Such people are worse than unbelievers. Interesting, isn't it? The credibility issue gets brought out here. And he says that you must, if you're going to be credible as a Christian, you got to take care of your own family. Right? This is going to be the substance that's going to display the fact that you truly believe. Now, it doesn't mean that you're the only one who takes care of your family. It doesn't mean that there's not room for an assisted living facility or nursing home or other people or working together as a family. It doesn't mean that you have to carry all that weight. But it's just that a true expression of faith here is that it cannot be ignored, the responsibility towards family, simply because it's going to cost service and sacrifice on our part. We cannot just ignore it. And then he says this interesting thing at the end. They have denied the true faith, and such people are worse than unbelievers. Now, it's not saying that every unbeliever hates his family. That non-Christians are the worst people ever, and they never take care of their family, and you're even worse than that. That's not his argument. Let me give you my modern version of his argument. The unbeliever, if there were an unbeliever who didn't take care of their family, and you ask them, why do you not take care of your parents? They could give you a very logical argument that you would have a hard time arguing with. That would be my perspective on it. Is that if you talk to a non-Christian, said, hey, you don't really care for your parents. And he could say, not that he would, but he could say, you know what? I'm an evolutionist. I believe in survival of the fittest. The weak have to go. And you would go, oh, that sounds cruel. And you'd be like, how would that be cruel? On what basis would you judge that as being cruel? If you come from nowhere, you go to nowhere, any value system you create along the way is merely just that, something created along the way. So there'd be no way to really evaluate as being good or bad, but we do know survival of the fittest, the weak have to go. They're going to hold the rest of us back. It'd be a logical conclusion. If you said, why don't you take care of your family? Because, well, I don't know if I'm an evolutionist, but I'm a humanist. I've decided that that this certain types of people don't have value and other types of people do have value. So I've decided that I want to put that time and energy into my children because I think they do have value, but I've decided my parents don't have value. So as a humanist, I get to use reason to determine and decide who I think's important, what has value, what doesn't have value. Or he could say, I'm a hedonist. Taking care of my family is cutting in to the pleasure and the joy that and the happiness that I want to experience. And I even have a government that says, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and this is getting in the way of all that. So they would be able to give you a logical, thoughtful even answer to why they're not taking care of their parents. But here's the reality. And you go, well, are you labeling all non-Christians? No, I'm not saying that. I know tons of non-Christians take care of their family. I'm just saying they could be consistent in their argument. But as a Christian, you could never bolster a consistent argument. If you don't take care of your family, you would say, why don't you? You have no good reasons. You have no good answers. You would have to be a hypocrite. You'd be like, well, Jesus took care of me, but I'm not going to take care of them. It's not a good argument. My parents took care of me, but I'm not taking care of them. They took care of me, I'm not taking care of them. That's not a good argument. There just are no good arguments if you're a Christian. In fact, the compelling weight for you is that you were weak and vulnerable and inept, and he came after you, took care of you, take care of you physically and spiritually. And so he says, you are denying the faith, you're denying the very core and the root of who we are and what we believe. And in that sense, you're becoming a hypocrite because you're not doing your part. I have some friends who just are on the back end, have just buried one of their parents. They're in their late 60s, early 70s, and just had mom die who was in her 90s. And on 3 or 4 years of just intense care for the mother. And it has been a journey that no one would choose. And there has been growth that no one would pursue. There has been a stretching that you would never choose in a million years. But God has been right in the middle of all of that for them and has caused them to grow and be changed and be challenged and stretched in new ways. And here's what I've noticed about the aging parents, as difficult as this can be, is that there is some real healing that usually takes place in that child-parent relationship as the roles kind of reverse. Is that some of the blame that was thrown on parents and some of the things that happened that we're trying to figure out why did that happen and why did I get neglected or abused in that way? When the roles begin to reverse, some clarity comes to the forefront around the relationship, and I've seen a lot of healing take place in that context. But it is not something that we would choose, but Jesus is in the middle of it, and there's lots of growth to be had right there. Verse 9. A widow who is put on the list for support must be a woman who's at least 60 years old. So what's he saying? That there's going to be a list, and we're going to put widows on the list, and then we're going to take care of them. Why? Because they can't take care of themselves. Right? They're vulnerable. She's 60 years old, faithful to her husband. She must be well respected by everyone because of all the good that she has done. And then there's a series of questions. Has she brought up her children well? Has she been kind to strangers and served others, other believers humbly? Has she helped those who are in trouble? Has she been ready to do good? Why the stipulations? Because this is a unique group of people. Is that she is vulnerable? But she is also godly. And you go, well, what about people who are vulnerable who are not godly? That's called outreach. But what's happening here is we are saying she is where? She is in the family. And for all the people that we might reach, and for all the people that we might take care of, this is someone that we are most certainly going to take care of. Is that she's in the family. She epitomizes everything that family stands for. That if Jesus has made us a family and we're supposed to care for one another, then most certainly this is someone who's not going to fall through the cracks. And so she has displayed, 60 years old, faithful, respected, all the good she's done. She's displayed the credibility of her faith. And now the church has an opportunity to display the credibility of her faith as a church. It's very interesting how he brings together all these ideas, isn't it? In something that's seemingly very practical, you could read through in a moment. But she has some credibility. Now here, let me tell you someone who doesn't have credibility, because I get this happens all the time, right? So I walk out the office of our church, and there's a guy standing there. He goes, hey man, I'm homeless, I don't have any money, and I need $22.85 to get to Gastonia. And I was like, $22.85 to get to Gastonia. So when you do this year after year, right, and you meet so many people and you learn how the system works. So what I learned early on is because they're like, oh, church, pastor, ask them for money. Churches just hand out money all the time. People just ask for money and you just hand it out. It's what you're expected to do. But I've learned if you ask 20 questions really, really fast, that guy will contradict himself so many times, you'll catch him in three or four lies. And it becomes a very engaging kind of process. I enjoy it, actually. So he's like, I need $22.85 to get to Gastoni. And I can give you 100 stories. It always goes generally about the same way, except for a handful of times. So I ask him 20 questions really fast. He proves that he's lied to three or four times because he keeps contradicting his own story. And so when we get to the end, I was like, hey, bro, here's the thing. I can't give you that money. He goes, you don't have no money? I was like, no, I got money. I didn't say I didn't have money. I got money. I'm just not giving it to you. He goes, why are you not giving it? Why you don't give it to me? I was like, I don't believe anything you said. He goes, I thought this was a church. I was like, you thought I was a church? He's like, I know, because he's drunk anyway. And I'm like, he goes, no. I thought you were in a church. I was like, okay, I am in the church. He goes, and I thought, you know, if you're the church, what would, he goes, here, hey, let me ask you this. What would Jesus do? I was like, well, let me find out. I'll ask him real quick. Jesus told me to not give you any money. He goes, man, you ain't telling the truth. I was like, it's tough working with a liar, isn't it? It's frustrating. He goes, I just need some money. I was like, look, we had a deal. You lie to me first, I lie to you second. That was the deal we just made. Next time I get to go first. Right? And so you can go round and round. And finally he's like, all right, forget it. Because what I found out is I'm in the middle of the night with these guys trying to help them, and they lie to you so many times. So you have to find out. And when those who are telling the truth, who are sincere, who want help, otherwise I wind up funding a habit, which I have done so many times I can't even begin to tell you, right? Not just thrown money away, but funded something that is ungodly. Okay, now you go, well, we got to reach those people. Hey, I hear you. We do. And we do. For those who want help, we are here to help. And we have helped tons, all right? And we do help. We will help. But that whole process, that is not this. She is obviously credible. She is not lying about anything. She has a life that has shown the kind of credibility and godliness that warrants the church acknowledging her as family. Verse 11. The younger widow should not be put on the list. Now here's where it gets controversial. Some people are not going on the list. Younger widows should not go on the list, not because they're not credible, but because their physical desires will overpower their devotion to Christ, and they will want to remarry. What's wrong with remarrying? Nothing's wrong with remarrying. But then they would be guilty of breaking a previous pledge. If they said, husband died, I'm going to be a widow, I'm going to go on the list. I'm going to go on the list, I'll serve the church, I'll serve people, and they'll pay for me to live. And he goes, but no. What's going to happen is if they're young, because of their physical desires, that'll overpower their devotion to Christ and they'll want to remarry. He goes, why set them up for failure? I learned this the hard way. I was living in Dallas in seminary. I had this guy that we knew was an established insurance broker. He goes, hey, you need some life insurance. You need to start investing. I was like, invest? What do I have to invest? $10 a month in a mutual fund. I was like, okay, that actually turned out to be a good discipline, by the way. But he said, you need a little bit of life insurance. I was like, I don't even know what that is. So he explained to me term life insurance. He goes, and you just need enough so that Vicky can bury you, get you in the ground, move on with her life. And then, you don't need a whole bunch for her, though, because she's going to get remarried, and then she'll get on with her life. And I was like, whoa. Back up. He said, what? I was like, what? Say that part again. He's like, she just needs enough to get you buried. Doesn't need a ton. I was like, no, not that part. He goes, she'll get a job and move on. I was like, no, for that. He's like, she's going to remarry. I was like, to who? Because I'm going to go find him. He's like, I don't know who she's going to remarry. She's young. And it got clear to me. Oh, there would be life after me. It's devastating. I was like, then you're right. She ain't getting much insurance money then. That's right. That would be, no, I'll pay her back right now. He says, there's no need to put her in the position to fail. So here's what's going to happen. Verse 13. And if they're on the list, they're young, they have energy, but no responsibility. Young, being paid to live, energy, but no responsibility, no weight. They'll learn to be lazy and spend their time gossiping, going from house to house, meddling other people's business, talking about things they shouldn't talk about. What's he saying? If they're young and they lose their husband, it's a tragedy. They should do what? Go to work. They'll go to work until life changes. Now, let's be clear on this. And this is a lost art in our culture. It is losing ground very quickly. Is that work is a good thing. It is a pre-fall idea, which means it's before the corruption, before the fall of our universe. It is a good thing God created Adam to work. It's a good thing. Now, it has been corrupted, but we have men craving retirement, which is fine, but you may retire from one thing, but it doesn't mean you get to shut down and just stop working. We're going to do a roundtable in the spring, kind of winter spring, hopefully, on work, because we got to redeem this idea. Our children and students need to learn how to work at an early age. 8, 9 years old, they need to have chores that they are responsible for. Preteens need to be carrying significant responsibility in your home. Teenagers need to be able to go handle whole issues without parents being involved. They need to have that kind of weight, that kind of responsibility. This is a good thing, not a bad thing. And here, these women have suffered a loss, but since they are young, work is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And so they should go work in the season between first marriage and second marriage, whether they were working there or working there. Becoming a widow doesn't change the fact that they can be productive rather than learning to be. And notice he grants them that. They will learn to be lazy. Not that they are now. They will learn these bad habits because of the position that the church puts them in. Now he's going to hold up a few values. Caring for people. Working. Marriage. And even remarriage. He's holding up all these values. But when people read a passage like this and something gets held up, they think, well, since he's holding up one thing, he's throwing other things to the side. But look at the next phrase. Verse 14, and this is what gets held up sometimes and other stuff gets thrown to the side. So I advise the younger widows to marry again and have children, take care of their own homes. You're like, oh, he's a sexist. He's saying that women can't do anything. All they can do is marry and have children, take care of their home. That's not what he's saying. He just got through saying go to work. So first marriage ends because of death, whatever, she's a widow. Go to work, be productive, and then He holds up that value of being productive, but then he also holds up this value of be married, have children, be fruitful, multiply. He's holding up all of that. Now you go, well, we're going to have to, maybe for a season, we're going to scale back some kind of work so we can focus on family. We've got lots of verses that say that. So nothing wrong with that, but he holds up the value of all of this. That marriage is a good thing. Having children is a good thing. There is no greater investment than in your time and energy than creating a sanctuary called the home where little people, little men and women, get to grow and flourish in their lives. They get to come to faith. Their lives get to be changed. So embracing the value of a nurturing home, we are not shying away from that. And so my wife has worked inside the home, outside the home. And then there was a season where we had kids like crazy. So we're like, hey, we don't have time right now for you to work outside the home, and I make no money, so I'm working two jobs just so we can kind of hold all that together. And then now she has some contribution that's mostly inside the home, a little bit outside the home. But he says this is a good thing. Her work is a good thing. A marrying again is a good thing. Having children is a good thing. Holding up all those values at the same time. All that's good. Verse 15. Because I'm afraid that some of them, who? These young widows, have already gone astray and now follow Satan. Why? Maybe because they're lazy. Maybe because they're gossiping. Maybe because they're going house to house. Maybe because they're meddling in other people's business. Maybe because they're not being productive. Maybe because they've even met up with someone and hooked up. Maybe they're in a physical relationship with someone. Maybe they're living with someone. Maybe it's turned immoral. We don't really know. Following Satan, I don't think it's this big, terrible, mystical thing. It's just they've become immoral in some way. They're in sin in some way. He says, so I advise them to do this. Move away from this temptation. I'm afraid that some have already gone astray. In verse 16, if a woman who is a believer has relatives who are widows, she must take care of them, not put the responsibility on the church. So see how the church and the family are working together. If the family can handle it, family handles it. If there is no family, then the church handles it. then the church can care for the widows who are truly alone, which he has qualified that. Let me give you some applications for our church. Some things that I'm thinking about throughout the week. And this scratches the surface on, there's a lot more tethered to it, but let me just give you a handful of things. The first one is this. It's the obvious big idea, is that it's our responsibility to take care of our family. Me, my family, you for your family. It's how God created these little pods called family that can rally energy towards one another, take care of one another. And when we do that, we affirm the value of those that are weak and frail. We say in those moments that your ability to be strong or powerful does not equate to value. Right? Because in our culture, performance equals value. Wealth, prominence, those things get equated with value. But when we take care of the weak, we align ourselves with God and we say that no matter what you can or cannot do, you have value. You're creating the image of God. And we affirm that. And then in that role, we get to be like God. We get to follow in his steps and pursue and care for those who are weak and can't take care of themselves. How do you get the energy for that? You keep reminding yourself, that's me. I'm the one who's weak. I'm the one who's frail. I'm the one who has to be pursued. I'm the one who has to be cared for. Jesus had to come take care of me. He brought his strength to me the way I'm bringing my strength to someone else, to a parent, to a sibling. And we, in those moments, display our faith through our sacrifice for others. It is a beautiful picture of the message of Jesus. Now, once again, the bootstrapper, if you're a bootstrapper woman or a bootstrapper man, right here, I feel you, right? Let me just tell you. There are parts of us that deny the cross and the message of Jesus in ways that we are not even aware of. You have to constantly search your soul about how you deny the power of the cross and the power of the gospel because you're constantly trying to do it yourself. Now, for half the population, that isn't you, right? But for a lot of us in the room, we are denying the gospel all the time and don't even realize it. Second idea is that we, as a church, are to take care of widows and orphans. There are other aspects of our culture where there are vulnerabilities too. There are other vulnerabilities, but these are the two that we're focused on. Widows and orphans. We're to take care of those. And so maybe they're not in our family, but maybe as a church, we have to rally to that. If you remember, early in Acts chapter 6, what's going on? If we find out that the early church has some widows who speak Greek rather than Hebrew, which makes them a second-class Jew, which means that they get overlooked in the daily distribution of food. And so that is a justice issue where the weak and the vulnerable are being overlooked, not by the government, being overlooked by the church. And that has to come to the highest places of leadership in the church so they can go, oh, we have to allocate resources. We have to redirect energy. It is not wrong that it was missed. Now, granted, it is wrong that there's that kind of sin and tension in the church, right? But from the leadership perspective, it's not wrong that it was missed in the beginning. But that surfaces to them and they deal with it. And so wherever we see that there is a wrong and injustice, as individuals or as a church, we need to move towards it. And here's what I would say for you individually, is that for some of us in our congregation, is that your hands are too clean. Life too clean, hands too clean. You need some mess on you. There are some people around you who are suffering and you need to get involved in that. And you go, well, wait, what is it? No. No, you can put that on me. That's on you. It's on you to figure out between you and God and your community group. You go talk about it. Hey, my life is too focused on the wrong things or too clean. Third idea is that we as a church are heavily involved in fostering and adoption and are on the front end of figuring out how to allocate resources for that. Like I said, over 50 folks that we are serving and resourcing. And so providing things like a date night to support families who are taking on new burden. We are partnering with other churches. And Scott Freeman was filling me in this week. He said, it seems like some of the churches in our community that we are starting to connect with, each of them have a unique contribution. One church has figured out how to do the licensing, where they allocate a day where you show up and they have all the paperwork and all the experts, and you can just get all that licensing and paperwork done in a day. And you're just done. Get it all done. So you don't have to keep going to this office and what else do I need to do? Oh, I didn't get that signed, didn't get that piece of paper. They figured all that out. Another one does a great job of coming alongside you and helping upfit your house so that it is up to code for when kids come to live there. That there are certain code restrictions and requirements that the government demands, and they help get you ready for that. And we're thinking that our niche is going to be in gathering resources, clothes, toys, diapers, furniture. We have the kind of resources where we're gathering that. So we have a closet that looks like this. I think we have a slide for this that shows clothes that we're storing. So we have a couple rooms on the Pelham Road campus that are already full. But here's what we're going to do. On Saturday, November 17th, from 9 to 12, we want you to bring more, which is not going to fit in there. We've got to find a warehouse. So if you're someone who owns a business or you have warehouse space, we're in the process of looking for some warehouse space where we can store, because we have a bunch more coming. I mean, if I had been contributing to this over the last 5 years, I could supply all of Greenville County. Right? I could have done it myself, right? But I've given away mostly to Miracle Hill. But we want to be a part of it too. So that'll be announced. It'll be coming more. But that's a role that we think we can play. And if you want information about how our church is playing a role here, if you're like, hey, I'd like to learn more about adoption, I'd like to learn more about fostering, you call the church office, send us an email, and we'll connect you to some of our staff and volunteers who handle all that, who can just give you information. Because we're not having to say, oh, you should feel guilty and get involved. No, you should feel God's doing a work. You should explore it and see what he continues to do. And then the fourth idea. I said, as we get into Thanksgiving and Christmas, it is an opportunity for us to connect to the community in Greenville and Allendale particularly, but particularly around Greenville County and parts of Anderson County, is that we use this moment to create some movement where we minister to people throughout the year who are vulnerable. So we've done, this past year, over 400 children we've taken on cultural trips. And a cultural trip is getting them out of the kind of desperate situation they're in to go, hey, here's what life could be like. You don't get pregnant, you study in school, you stay in school, you make good grades, and your life could be like that. Merging good works with the gospel, good news of the gospel, trying to merge all that together. We provided over 3,500 meals to kids on weekends because they have good meals during the week because the school government pays for it, but on the weekends they don't have good meals. So we've been doing that throughout the year. And then over Thanksgiving and Christmas, we're going to provide meals for children during Thanksgiving all around Anderson and Greenville County. And we're going to provide stuff for them at Christmas. All right? And so Greenville Connect's trying to do 1,300 boxes of love, and we're going to be a part of that. All right? And so let me just show you some of this goes all the way into Allendale County. And so we are working all over the counties that we are surrounded by to try to have influence. And some of that happens during this season, but some of it is spread throughout the year. It creates credibility throughout the year. So here's what I'm telling you. If you give to Grace Church, that's why we call it One Fund, because some of our money goes overseas, some of it stays here. Some of it helps the poor, some of it helps equip volunteers, some of it helps pay for our staff, some of it builds buildings, but it's all One Fund. So if you've been giving, here's what I'm telling you. You give a dollar to Grace Church, you've already been supporting all this. All these meals, kids, those who are vulnerable, whether it's in Kenya, Allendale, or Greenville County, or Anderson County, downtown, Powdersville, Golden Strip, Pelham Road, if you've given a dollar, you've already given to all this. Now, we're going to give you some more opportunities when we get right up to Thanksgiving and Christmas and go, hey, if you haven't been giving, here's an opportunity for you to give to it. You go, give what? Give my time? No, you can give your time. Money. Okay, we can take physical money, buy things to be a blessing to people, and in blessing people, then we have credibility to share the gospel. All of that, right? So, like for our family, we give, so we help fund all that. But when we get to this time of the year, my wife says, oh, but I also want to do this. That's fine. You can do more, you can do both. Number five, we as a church, I say all the time when people say, tell me about your church. I was like, no, we're this and we're this. And I'll share a few things. I'll say, in another way though, here's the thing. We're a Midwest church. Very few people are born and raised in Greenville. Most of us come from the North or from the Midwest, right? So what that means is a lot of us don't have family that can kind of help rally when someone's sick or help take care of our kids in a difficult situation. And so if you're going to be a part of Grace Church, no matter what campus, where you are, your head needs to be on a swivel looking for opportunities to help others. Because when we started, we had almost no people in our church, and everybody was in the same situation we were. And I would just tell you, my wife's family's from here, and if it weren't for my mother-in-law and father-in-law, I don't think we could have planted this church. Because there were nights when kids were sick, one's going to the doctor, hospital, something. I've got to be somewhere, I'm traveling out of town, whatever, and so to have people who can help. So we as a church, when the original family can't help, we as a church need to be able to take care of one another in difficult times, illnesses, because that's what Jesus did for us. So he calls us to serve one another. He calls us to sacrifice for one another. And here's the thing, he's not blinking when he does that. Jesus doesn't feel bad or feel guilty going, oh, I'm putting a lot of pressure on you to sacrifice for one another in your physical family or in your spiritual family. Jesus says, you wouldn't have anything had I not come after you and given it to you. I found you. I rescued you. I gave you life. The life that I'm asking you to give away for someone else, Jesus says, that life I'm asking you to give away, I gave it to you. And I will give you more. I will give you more life. But if you store it up for yourself, it'll corrode on you. So Jesus has made peace between us and the Father, and he's made peace between us as individuals and as a group. So an opportunity to worship him and remember that we were vulnerable and are vulnerable. He came for us, and we get to be there for others. Let's pray. Father, we ask now as we sing songs, as we worship you, as we bow our heads and our hearts before you, that you would, through your Spirit, lead us. That you would lead us into places that we cannot go ourselves. That you would lead us to a place of honesty that we are not prepared to acknowledge on our own. And then you would give us the grace and the freedom to know that you've loved us from eternity past. That you have loved us freely and unconditionally, and so you love us now, so there's no reason to hide from you. And so, Father, for those of us who have not been generous, would you break our hearts for our selfishness and our wrong focus on ourselves? For those of us who need to consider fostering our adoption, would you open that idea to us? For those of us who have people around us in need that we need to move towards, either physically or emotionally, that you would inspire us, that you would give us courage to do that. Father, would you allow us to merge our faith and our works together in a moment like this, and that people around us will be able to see the credibility of the gospel in how we live and in how we love. In Jesus' name.